materials, and another for making the bus-sized fairings that wrap around the satellites. Hundreds of people move about at the same time through the factory, a mix of gritty technicians with tattoos and bandanas and young white-collar engineers. The sweaty smell of boys who have just come off the playground permeates the building and hints at its non-stop activity. Musk has left his personal touches throughout the factory. There are small things like the data center that has been bathed in blue lights to give it a sci-fi feel. The refrigerator-sized computers under the lights have been labeled with big block letters to make it look like they were made by Cyberdyne Systems, the fictional company from the Terminator movie franchise. Near the elevators, Musk has placed a glowing life-size Iron Man figure. Surely the factory's most Muskian element is the office space that has been built smack dab in its center. This is a three-story glass structure with meeting rooms and desks that rises up between various welding and construction areas. It looks and feels bizarre to have a see-through office inside this hive of industry. Musk, though, wanted his engineers to watch what was going on with the machines at all times, and to make sure they had to walk through the factory and talk to the technicians on the way to their desks. The factory is a temple devoted to what SpaceX sees as its major weapon in the rocket-building game, in-house manufacturing. SpaceX manufactures between 80% and 90% of its rockets, engines, electronics, and other parts. It's a strategy that flat-out dumbfounds SpaceX's competitors, like United Launch Alliance, or ULA, which openly brags about depending on more than 1,200 suppliers to make its end products. ULA, a partnership between Lockheed Martin and Boeing, sees itself as an engine of job creation rather than a model of inefficiency. A typical aerospace company comes up with a list of parts that it needs for a launch system and then hands off their design and specifications to myriad third parties who then actually build the hardware. SpaceX tends to buy as little as possible to save money, and because it sees depending on suppliers, especially foreign ones, as a weakness. This approach comes off as excessive at first blush. Companies have made things like radios and power distribution units for decades. Reinventing the wheel for every computer and machine on a rocket could introduce more chances for error, and in general, be a waste of time. But for SpaceX, the strategy works. In addition to building its own engines, rocket bodies, and capsules, SpaceX designs its own motherboards and circuits, sensors to detect vibrations, flight computers, and solar panels. Just by streamlining a radio, for instance, SpaceX's engineers have found that they can reduce the weight of the device by about 20%. And the cost savings for a homemade radio are dramatic, dropping from between $50,000 to $100,000 for the industrial-grade equipment used by aerospace companies to $5,000 for SpaceX's unit. It's hard to believe these kinds of price differentials at first, but there are dozens, if not hundreds, of places where SpaceX has secured such savings. The equipment at SpaceX tends to be built out of readily available consumer electronics, as opposed to space-grade equipment used by others in the industry. SpaceX has had to work for years to prove to NASA that standard electronics have gotten good enough to compete with the more expensive, specialized gear trusted in years past. Traditional aerospace has been doing things the same way for a very, very long time, said Drew Eldeen, a former SpaceX engineer. The biggest challenge was convincing NASA to give something new a try and building a paper trail that showed the parts were high enough quality. To prove that it's making the right choice to NASA and itself, SpaceX will sometimes load a rocket with both the standard equipment and prototypes of its own design for testing during flight. Engineers then compare the performance characteristics of the devices. Once a SpaceX design equals or outperforms the commercial products, it becomes the de facto hardware. There have also been numerous times when SpaceX has done pioneering work on advancing very complex hardware systems. A classic example of this is one of the factory's weirder-looking contraptions, a two-story machine designed to perform what's known as friction stir welding. The machine allows SpaceX to automate the welding process for massive sheets of metal, like the ones that make up the bodies of the Falcon rockets. An arm takes one of the rocket's body panels, lines it up against another body panel, and then joins them together with a weld that could run 20 feet or more. Aerospace companies typically try to avoid welds whenever possible because they create weaknesses in the metal, and that's limited the size of metal sheets they can use and forced other design constraints. From the early days of SpaceX, Musk pushed the company to master friction stir welding, in which a spinning head is smashed at high speeds into the join between two pieces of metal, in a bid to make their crystalline structures merge. It's as if you heated two sheets of aluminum foil and then joined them by putting your thumb down on the seam and twisting the metal together. This type of welding tends to result in much stronger bonds than traditional welds. Companies had performed friction stir welding before, but not on structures as large as a rocket's body, or to the degree to which SpaceX has used the technique. As a result of its trials and errors, SpaceX can now join large, thin sheets of metal and shave hundreds of pounds off the weight of the Falcon rockets, as it's able to use lighter weight alloys and avoid using rivets, fasteners, and other support structures. Musk's competitors in the auto industry might soon need to do the same, because SpaceX has transferred some of the equipment and techniques to Tesla. The hope is that Tesla will be able to make lighter, stronger cars. The technology has proven so valuable that SpaceX's competitors have started to copy it and have tried to poach some of the company's experts in the field. Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos's secretive rocket company, has been particularly aggressive, hiring away Ray Myrietka, one of the world's foremost friction stir welding experts, and igniting a major rift with Musk. Blue Origin does these surgical strikes on specialized talent. Blue Origin also hired away a large chunk of SpaceX's propulsion team, offering like double their salaries. "I think it's unnecessary and a bit rude," Musk said. Within SpaceX, Blue Origin is mockingly referred to as BO, and at one point, the company created an email filter to detect messages with Blue and Origin to block the poaching. The relationship between Musk and Bezos has soured, and they no longer chat about their shared ambition of getting to Mars. "I do think Bezos has an insatiable desire to be King Bezos," Musk said. "He has a relentless work ethic and wants to kill everything in e-commerce. But he's not the most fun guy, honestly." Musk has taken exception to Blue Origin and Bezos filing for patents around reusable rocket technology as well. "His patent is completely ridiculous," Musk said. "People have proposed landing on a floating platform in the ocean for a half century. There's no chance whatsoever of the patent being upheld because there's 5 decades of prior art of people who propose that 6 ways to Sunday, in fiction and nonfiction. It's like Dr. Seuss, Green Eggs, and fucking ham. That's how many ways it's been proposed. The issue is doing it, and like actually creating a rocket that can make that happen." In the early days of SpaceX, Musk knew little about the machines and amount of grunt work that goes into making rockets. He rebuffed requests to buy specialized tooling equipment until the engineers could explain in clear terms why they needed certain things, and until experience taught him better. Musk also had yet to master some of the management techniques for which he would become both famous and, to some degree, infamous. Musk's growth as a CEO and rocket expert occurred alongside SpaceX's maturation as a company. At the start of the Falcon 1 journey, Musk was a forceful software executive, trying to learn some basic things about a very different world. at Zip2 and PayPal, he felt comfortable standing up for his positions and directing teams of coders. At SpaceX, he had to pick things up on the job. Musk initially relied on textbooks to form the bulk of his rocketry knowledge. But as SpaceX hired one brilliant person after another, Musk realized he could tap into their stores of knowledge. He would trap an engineer in the SpaceX factory and set to work grilling him about a type of valve or specialized material. "I thought at first that he was challenging me to see if I knew my stuff," said Kevin Brogan, one of the early engineers. "Then I realized he was trying to learn things. He would quiz you until he learned 90% of what you know." People who have spent significant time with Musk will attest to his abilities to absorb incredible quantities of information with near flawless recall. It's one of his most impressive and intimidating skills, and seems to work just as well in the present day as it did when he was a child vacuuming books into his brain. After a couple of years running SpaceX, Musk had turned into an aerospace expert on a level that few technology CEOs ever approach in their respective fields. He was teaching us about the value of time, and we were teaching him about rocketry, Brogan said. In regards to time, Musk may well set more aggressive delivery targets for very difficult-to-make products than any executive in history. Both his employees and the public have found this to be one of the more jarring aspects of Musk's character. "Elon has always been optimistic," Brogan said. "That's the nice word. He can be a downright liar about when things need to get done. He will pick the most aggressive time schedule imaginable, assuming everything goes right, and then accelerate it by assuming that everyone can work harder." Musk has been pilloried by the press for setting and then missing product delivery dates. It's one of the habits that got him in the most trouble as SpaceX and Tesla tried to bring their first products to market. Time and again, Musk found himself making a public appearance where he had to come up with a new batch of excuses for a delay. Reminded about the initial 2003 target date to fly the Falcon 1, Musk acted shocked. "Are you serious?" he said. "We said that? Okay, that's ridiculous. I think I just didn't know what the hell I was talking about. The only thing I had prior experience in was software. And yeah, you can write a bunch of software and launch a website in a year. No problem. This isn't like software. It doesn't work that way with rockets." Musk simply cannot help himself. He's an optimist by nature, and it can feel like he makes calculations for how long it will take to do something based on the idea that things will progress without flaw at every step and that all the members of his team have Muskian abilities and work ethics. As Brogan joked, Musk might forecast how long a software project will take by timing the amount of seconds needed physically to write a line of code and then extrapolating that out to match however many lines of code he expects the final piece of software to be. It's an imperfect analogy, but one that does not seem that far off from Musk's worldview. "Everything he does is fast," Brogan said. "He pees fast. It's like a fire hose. 3 seconds and out. He's authentically in a hurry." Asked about his approach, Musk said, "I certainly don't try to set impossible goals. I think impossible goals are demotivating. You don't want to tell people to go through a wall by banging their head against it. I don't ever set intentionally impossible goals, but I've certainly always been optimistic on time frames. I'm trying to recalibrate to be a little more realistic. I don't assume that it's just like 100 of me or something like that. I mean, in the case of the early SpaceX days, it would have been just a lack of understanding of what it takes to develop a rocket. In that case, I was off by, say, 200%. I think future programs might be off by anywhere from, like, 25% to 50%, as opposed to 200%. So I think generally you do want to have a timeline where, based on everything you know about, the schedule should be X, and you execute towards that, but with the understanding that there will be all sorts of things that you don't know about that you will encounter that will push the date beyond that. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have tried to aim for that date from the beginning, because aiming for something else would have been an arbitrary time increase. It's different to say, well, what do you promise people? Because you want to try to promise people something that includes schedule margin. But in order to achieve the external promised schedule, you've got to have an internal schedule that's more aggressive than that. Sometimes you still miss the external schedule. SpaceX, by the way, is not alone here. Being late is par for the course in the aerospace industry. It's not a question of if it's late, it's how late will the program be. I don't think an aerospace program has been completed on time since bloody World War II. Dealing with the epically aggressive schedules and Musk's expectations has required SpaceX's engineers to develop a variety of survival techniques. Musk often asks for highly detailed proposals for how projects will be accomplished. The employees have learned never to break the time needed to accomplish something down into months or weeks. Musk wants day-by-day and hour-by-hour forecasts, and sometimes even minute-by-minute countdowns, and the fallout from missed schedules is severe. You had to put in when you would go to the bathroom, Brogan said. Unlike Elon, sometimes people need to take a long dump. SpaceX's top managers work together to, in essence, create fake schedules that they know will please Musk, but that are basically impossible to achieve. This would not be such a horrible situation if the targets were kept internal. Musk, however, tends to quote these fake schedules to customers, unintentionally giving them false hope. Typically, it falls to Gwynne Shotwell, SpaceX's president, to clean up the resulting mess. She will either need to ring up a customer to give them a more realistic timeline or concoct a litany of excuses to explain away the inevitable delays. Poor Gwynne, Brogan said. Just to hear her on the phone with the customers is agonizing. There can be no question that Musk has mastered the art of getting the most out of his employees. Interview 36 SpaceX engineers, and each one of them will have picked up on a managerial nuance that Musk has used to get people to meet his deadlines. One example from Brogan, where a typical manager may set the deadline for the employee, Musk guides his engineers into taking ownership of their own delivery dates. He doesn't say, "You have to do this by Friday at 2 p.m., Brogan said. He says, "I need the impossible done by Friday at 2 p.m. Can you do it?" Then, when you say yes, you are not working hard because he told you to. You're working hard for yourself. It's a distinction you can feel. You have signed up to do your own work. And by recruiting hundreds of bright, self-motivated people, SpaceX has maximized the power of the individual. One person putting in a 16-hour day ends up being much more effective than two people working 8-hour days together. The individual doesn't have to hold meetings, reach a consensus, or bring other people up to speed on a project. He just keeps working and working and working. The ideal SpaceX employee is someone like Steve Davis, the Director of Advanced Projects at SpaceX. He's been working 16 hours a day, every day, for years, Brogan said. He gets more done than 11 people working together. To find Davis, Musk called a teaching assistant, Michael Colano, in Stanford's aeronautics department, and asked him if there were any hard-working, bright master's and doctoral candidates who didn't have families. The TA pointed Musk to Davis, who was pursuing a master's degree in aerospace engineering to add to degrees in finance, mechanical engineering, and particle physics. Musk called Davis on a Wednesday and offered him a job the following Friday. Davis was the 22nd SpaceX hire and has ended up the 12th most senior person still at the company. He turned 35 in 2014. Davis did his tour of duty on Quadge and considered it the greatest time of his life. Every night, you could either sleep by the rocket in this tent shelter where the geckos crawled all over you, or take this one-hour boat ride that made you seasick back to the main island, he said. Every night, you had to pick the pain that you remembered least. You got so hot and exhausted. It was just amazing. After working on the Falcon 1, Davis moved to the Falcon 9, and then Dragon. The Dragon capsule took SpaceX 4 years to design. It's likely the fastest project of its ilk done in the history of the aerospace industry. The project started with Musk and a handful of engineers, most of them under 30 years old, and peaked at 100 people. According to Musk, "The early Dragon version 1 work was just me and maybe 3 or 4 engineers, as we were living hand-to-mouth and had no idea if NASA would award us a contract. Technically, there was Magic Dragon before that, which was much simpler, as it had no NASA requirements. Magic Dragon was just me and some high-altitude balloon guys in the UK." They cribbed from past capsule work and read over every paper published by NASA and other aeronautics bodies around projects like Gemini and Apollo. If you go search for something like Apollo's reentry guidance algorithm, there are these great databases that will just spit out the answer, Davis said. The engineers at SpaceX then had to figure out how to advance these past efforts and bring the capsule into the modern age. Some of the areas of improvement were obvious and easily accomplished, while others required more ingenuity. Saturn V and Apollo had colossal computing bays that produced only a fraction of the computer horsepower that can be achieved today on, say, an iPad. The SpaceX engineers knew they could save a lot of room by cutting out some of the computers, while also adding capabilities with their more powerful equipment. The engineers decided that while Dragon would look a lot like Apollo, it would have steeper wall angles to clear space for gear and for the astronauts that the company hoped to fly. SpaceX also got the recipe for its heat shield material, called Pica, through a deal with NASA. The SpaceX engineers found out how to make the Pica material less expensively and improved the underlying recipe so that Dragon, from day one, could withstand the heat of a re-entry coming back from Mars. NASA researchers studying the Dragon design have noticed several features of the capsule that appear to have been purpose-built from the get-go to accommodate a landing on Mars. They've published a couple of papers explaining how it could be feasible for NASA to fund a mission to Mars in which a Dragon capsule picks up samples and returns them to Earth. The total cost for Dragon came in at $300 million, which would be on the order of 10 to 30 times less than capsule projects built by other companies. "The metal comes in, we roll it out, weld it, and make things," Davis said. "We build almost everything in-house. That is why the costs have come down." Davis, like Brogan and plenty of other SpaceX engineers, has had Musk ask for the seemingly impossible. His favorite request dates back to 2004. SpaceX needed an actuator that would trigger the gimbal action used to steer the upper stage of Falcon 1. Davis had never built a piece of hardware before in his life, and naturally went out to find some suppliers who could make an electromechanical actuator for him. He got a quote back for $120,000. "Elon laughed," Davis said. He said, "That part is no more complicated than a garage door opener. Your budget is $5,000. Go make it work." Davis spent 9 months building the actuator. At the end of the process, he toiled for 3 hours writing an email to Musk covering the pros and cons of the device. The email went into gory detail about how Davis had designed the part, why he had made various choices, and what its cost would be. As he pressed send, Davis felt anxiety surge through his body, knowing that he'd given his all for almost a year to do something an engineer at another aerospace company would not even attempt. Musk rewarded all of this toil and angst with one of his standard responses. He wrote back, "Okay." The actuator Davis designed ended up costing $3,900 and flew with Falcon 1 into space. "I put every ounce of intellectual capital I had into that email, and 1 minute later got that simple response," Davis said. Everyone in the company was having that same experience. "One of my favorite things about Elon is his ability to make enormous decisions very quickly. That is still how it works today. Kevin Watson can attest to that. He arrived at SpaceX in 2008 after spending 24 years at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Watson worked on a wide variety of projects at JPL, including building and testing computing systems that could withstand the harsh conditions of space. JPL would typically buy expensive, specially toughened computers, and this frustrated Watson. He daydreamed about ways to handcraft much cheaper, equally effective computers. While having his job interview with Musk, Watson learned that SpaceX needed just this type of thinking. Musk wanted the bulk of a rocket's computing systems to cost no more than $10,000. It was an insane figure by aerospace industry standards, where the avionics system for a rocket typically cost well over $10 million. In traditional aerospace, it would cost you more than $10,000 just for the food at a meeting to discuss the cost of the avionics, Watson said. During the job interview, Watson promised Musk that he could do the improbable and deliver the $10,000 avionics system. He began working on making the computers for Dragon right after being hired. The first system was called CUCU, pronounced cuckoo. This communications box would go inside the International Space Station and communicate back with Dragon. A number of people at NASA referred to the SpaceX engineers as the guys in the garage and were cynical about the startup's ability to do much of anything, including building this type of machine. But SpaceX produced the communication computer in record time, and it ended up as the first system of its kind to pass NASA's protocol tests on the first try. NASA officials were forced to say cuckoo over and over again during meetings, a small act of defiance SpaceX had planned all along to torture NASA. As the months went on, Watson and other engineers built out the complete computing systems for Dragon and then adapted the technology for Falcon 9. The result was a fully redundant avionics platform that used a mix of off-the-shelf computing gear and products built in-house by SpaceX. It cost a bit more than $10,000, but came close to meeting Musk's goal. SpaceX reinvigorated Watson, who had become disenchanted with JPL's acceptance of wasteful spending and bureaucracy. Musk had to sign off on every expenditure over $10,000. It was his money that we were spending, and he was keeping an eye on it, as he damn well should, Watson said. He made sure nothing stupid was happening. Decisions were made quickly during weekly meetings, and the entire company bought into them. It was amazing how fast people would adapt to what came out of those meetings, Watson said. The entire ship could turn 90 degrees instantly. Lockheed Martin could never do anything like that. Watson continued, Elon is brilliant. He's involved in just about everything. He understands everything. If he asks you a question, you learn very quickly not to give him a gut reaction. He wants answers that get down to the fundamental laws of physics. One thing he understands really well is the physics of the rockets. He understands that like nobody else. The stuff I have seen him do in his head is crazy. He can get in discussions about flying a satellite and whether we can make the right orbit and deliver Dragon at the same time and solve all these equations in real time. It's amazing to watch the amount of knowledge he has accumulated over the years. I don't want to be the person who ever has to compete with Elon. You might as well leave the business and find something else fun to do. He will outmaneuver you, outthink you, and out-execute you. One of Watson's top discoveries at SpaceX was the test bed on the third floor of the Hawthorne factory. SpaceX has test versions of all the hardware and electronics that go into a rocket laid out on metal tables. It has, in effect, replicated the innards of a rocket end to end in order to run thousands of flight simulations. Someone launches the rocket from a computer, and then every piece of mechanical and computing hardware is monitored with sensors. An engineer can tell a valve to open, then check to see if it opened, how quickly it opened, and the level of current running to it. This testing apparatus lets SpaceX engineers practice ahead of launches and figure out how they would deal with all manner of anomalies. During the actual flights, SpaceX has people in the test facility who can replicate errors seen on Falcon or Dragon and make adjustments accordingly. SpaceX has made numerous changes on the fly with this system. In one case, someone spotted an error in a software file in the hours right before a launch. SpaceX's engineers changed the file, checked how it affected the test hardware, and when no problems were detected, sent the file to the Falcon 9, waiting on the launch pad, all in less than 30 minutes. NASA wasn't used to this, Watson said. If something went wrong with the shuttle, everyone was just resigned to waiting 3 weeks before they could try and launch again. From time to time, Musk will send out an email to the entire company to enforce a new policy or let them know about something that's bothering him. One of the more famous emails arrived in May 2010 with the subject line, "Acronyms seriously suck." There is a creeping tendency to use made-up acronyms at SpaceX. Excessive use of made-up acronyms is a significant impediment to communication, and keeping communication good as we grow is incredibly important. Individually, a few acronyms here and there may not seem so bad, but if 1,000 people are making these up, over time the result will be a huge glossary that we have to issue to new employees. No one can actually remember all these acronyms, and people don't want to seem dumb in a meeting, so they just sit there in ignorance. This is particularly tough on new employees. That needs to stop immediately, or I will take drastic action. I have given enough warnings over the years. Unless an acronym is approved by me, it should not enter the SpaceX glossary. If there is an existing acronym that cannot reasonably be justified, it should be eliminated, as I have requested in the past. For example, there should be no HTS, horizontal test stand, or VTS, vertical test stand, designations for test stands. Those are particularly dumb, as they contain unnecessary words. A stand at our test site is obviously a test stand. VTS-3 is 4 syllables compared with tripod, which is 2. So the bloody acronym version actually takes longer to say than the name. The key test for an acronym is to ask whether it helps or hurts communication. An acronym that most engineers outside of SpaceX already know, such as GUI, is fine to use. It is also okay to make up a few acronyms, contractions, every now and again, assuming I have approved them, e.g. MVAC and M9 instead of Merlin 1C Vacuum or Merlin 1C Sea Level. But those need to be kept to a minimum. This was classic Musk. The email is rough in its tone, and yet not really unwarranted for a guy who just wants things done as efficiently as possible. It obsesses over something that other people might find trivial, and yet he has a definite point. It's comical in that Musk wants all acronym approvals to run directly through him, but that's entirely in keeping with the hands-on management style that has, mainly, worked well at both SpaceX and Tesla. Employees have since dubbed the acronym policy the ASS rule. The guiding principle at SpaceX is to embrace your work and get stuff done. People who await guidance or detailed instructions languish. The same goes for workers who crave feedback. And the absolute worst thing that someone can do is inform Musk that what he's asking is impossible. An employee could be telling Musk that there's no way to get the cost on something like that actuator down to where he wants it, or that there is simply not enough time to build a part by Musk's deadline. Elon will say, "Fine, you're off the project, and I am now the CEO of the project. I will do your job and be CEO of 2 companies at the same time. I will deliver it," Brogan said. What's crazy is that Elon actually does it. Every time he's fired someone and taken their job, he's delivered on whatever the project was. It is jarring for both parties when the SpaceX culture rubs against more bureaucratic bodies like NASA, the U.S. Air Force, and the Federal Aviation Administration. The first inklings of these difficulties appeared on Quaj, where government officials sometimes questioned what they saw as SpaceX's cavalier approach to the launch process. There were times when SpaceX would want to make a change to its launch procedures, and any such change would require a pile of paperwork. SpaceX, for example, would have written down all the steps needed to replace a filter, put on gloves, wear safety goggles, remove a nut, and then want to alter this procedure or use a different type of filter. The FAA would need a week to review the new process before SpaceX could actually go about changing the filter on the rocket, a lag that both the engineers and Musk found ridiculous. On one occasion, after this type of thing happened, Musk laid into an FAA official while on a conference call with members of the SpaceX team and NASA. It got hot and heated, and he berated this guy on a personal level for like 10 minutes, Brogan said. Musk did not recall this incident, but did remember other confrontations with the FAA. One time he compiled a list of things an FAA subordinate had said during a meeting that Musk found silly, and sent the list along to the guy's boss. And then his dingbat manager sent me this long email about how he had been in the shuttle program and in charge of 20 launches or something like that, and how dare I say that the other guy was wrong, Musk said. I told him, not only is he wrong, and let me rearticulate the reasons, but you're wrong, and let me articulate the reasons. I don't think he sent me another email after that. We're trying to have a really big impact on the space industry. If the rules are such that you can't make progress, then you have to fight the rules. There is a fundamental problem with regulators. If a regulator agrees to change a rule and something bad happens, they could easily lose their career. Whereas if they change a rule and something good happens, they don't even get a reward. So it's very asymmetric. It's then very easy to understand why regulators resist changing the rules. It's because there's a big punishment on one side and no reward on the other. How would any rational person behave in such a scenario? In the middle of 2009, SpaceX hired Ken Bowersox, a former astronaut, as its vice president of astronaut safety and mission assurance. Bowersox fit the mold of recruit prized by a classic big aerospace company. He had a degree in aerospace engineering from the U.S. Naval Academy, had been a test pilot in the Air Force, and flew on the space shuttle a handful of times. Many people within SpaceX saw his arrival at the company as a good thing. He was considered a diligent, dignified sort who would provide a second set of eyes to many of SpaceX's procedures, checking to make sure the company went about things in a safe, standardized manner. Bowersox ended up smack in the middle of the constant pull and push at SpaceX between doing things efficiently and agonizing over traditional procedures. He and Musk were increasingly at odds as the months passed, and Bowersox started to feel as if his opinions were being ignored. During one incident in particular, a part made it all the way to the test stand with a major flaw, described by one engineer as the equivalent of a coffee cup not having a bottom, instead of being caught at the factory. According to observers, Bowersox argued that SpaceX should go back and investigate the process that led to the mistake and fix its root cause. Musk had already decided that he knew the basis of the problem and dismissed Bowersox after a couple of years on the job. Bowersox declined to speak on the record about his time at SpaceX. A number of people inside SpaceX saw the Bowersox incident as an example of Musk's hard-charging manner undermining some much-needed process. Musk had a totally different take on the situation, casting Bowersox as not being up to the engineering demands at SpaceX. A handful of high-ranking government officials gave me their candid takes on Musk, albeit without being willing to put their names to the remarks. One found Musk's treatment of Air Force generals and military men of similar rank appalling. Musk has been known to let even high-ranking officials have it when he thinks they're off base, and he is not apologetic about this. Another could not believe it when Musk would call very intelligent people idiots. Imagine the worst possible way that could come out, and it would come out, this person said. Life with Elon is like being in a very intimate married couple. He can be so gentle and loyal, and then really hard on people when it isn't necessary. One former official felt that Musk would need to temper himself better in the years to come if SpaceX was to keep currying favor with the military and government agencies in its bid to defeat the incumbent contractors. His biggest enemy will be himself and the way he treats people, this person said. When Musk rubs outsiders the wrong way, Shotwell is often there to try to smooth over the situation. Like Musk, she has a salty tongue and a fiery personality, but Shotwell is willing to play the role of the conciliator. These skills have allowed her to handle the day-to-day operations at SpaceX, leaving Musk to focus on the company's overall strategy, the product designs, marketing, and motivating employees. Like all of Musk's most trusted lieutenants, Shotwell has been willing to stay largely in the background, do her work, and focus on the company's cause. Shotwell grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, the daughter of an artist, mom, and a neurosurgeon, dad. She played the part of a bright, pretty girl, getting straight A's at school and joining the cheerleading squad. Shotwell had not expressed a major inclination toward the sciences and knew only one version of an engineer, the guy who drives a train. But there were clues that she was wired a bit different. She was the daughter who mowed the lawn and helped put the family basketball hoop together. In third grade, Shotwell developed a brief interest in car engines, and her mom bought a book detailing how they work. Later, in high school, Shotwell's mom forced her to attend a lecture at the Illinois Institute of Technology on a Saturday afternoon. As Shotwell listened to one of the panels, she grew enamored with a 50-year-old mechanical engineer. "She had these beautiful clothes, this suit and shoes that I loved," Shotwell said. "She was tall and carried off the heels really well." Shotwell chatted to the engineer after the talk, learning about her job. "That was the day I decided to become a mechanical engineer," she said. Shotwell went on to receive an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering and a master's degree in applied mathematics from Northwestern University. Then she took a job at Chrysler. It was a type of management training program meant for hotshot recent graduates who appeared to have leadership potential. Shotwell started out going to auto mechanics school. "I loved that." And then from department to department. While working on engines research, Shotwell found that there were two very expensive Cray supercomputers sitting idle because none of the veterans knew how to use them. A short while later, she logged onto the computers and set them up to run computational fluid dynamics, or CFD, operations to simulate the performance of valves and other components. The work kept Shotwell interested, but the environment started to grate on her. There were rules for everything, including lots of union regulations around who could operate certain machines. "I picked up a tool once and got written up," she said. "Then I opened a bottle of liquid nitrogen and got written up. I started thinking that the job was not what I had anticipated it would be." Shotwell pulled out of the Chrysler training program, regrouped at home, and then briefly pursued her doctorate in applied mathematics. While back on the Northwestern campus, one of her professors mentioned an opportunity at the Aerospace Corporation. Anything but a household name, Aerospace Corporation has been headquartered in El Segundo since 1960. Serving as a kind of neutral, non-profit organization that advises the Air Force, NASA, and other federal bodies on space programs. The company has a bureaucratic feel, but has proved very useful over the years with its research activities and ability to champion and nix costly endeavors. Shotwell started at Aerospace in October 1988 and worked on a wide range of projects. One job required her to develop a thermal model that depicted how temperature fluctuations in the space shuttle's cargo bay affected the performance of equipment on various payloads. She spent 10 years at Aerospace and honed her skills as a systems engineer. By the end, though, Shotwell had become irritated by the pace of the industry. "I didn't understand why it had to take 15 years to make a military satellite," she said. "You could see my interest was waning." For the next 4 years, Shotwell worked at Microcosm, a space startup just down the road from the Aerospace Corporation, and became the head of its space systems division and business development. Boasting a combination of smarts, confidence, direct talk, and good looks, Shotwell developed a reputation as a strong saleswoman. In 2002, one of her co-workers, Hans Königsmann, left for SpaceX. Shotwell took Königsmann out for a going-away lunch and dropped him off at SpaceX's then rinky-dink headquarters. "Hans told me to go in and meet Elon," Shotwell said. "I did, and that's when I told him, 'You need a good business development person.'" The next day, Mary Beth Brown called Shotwell and told her that Musk wanted to interview her for the new Vice President of Business Development position. Shotwell ended up as employee number 7. "I gave 3 weeks' notice at Microcosm and remodeled my bathroom because I knew I would not have a life after taking the job," she said. Through the early years of SpaceX, Shotwell pulled off the miraculous feat of selling something the company did not have. It took SpaceX so much longer than it had planned to have a successful flight. The failures along the way were embarrassing and bad for business. Nonetheless, Shotwell managed to sell about a dozen flights to a mix of government and commercial customers before SpaceX put its first Falcon 1 into orbit. Her deal-making skills extended to negotiating the big-ticket contracts with NASA that kept SpaceX alive during its leanest years, including a $278 million contract in August 2006 to begin work on vehicles that could ferry supplies to the ISS. Shotwell's track record of success turned her into Musk's ultimate confidant at SpaceX, and at the end of 2008, she became president and chief operating officer at the company. Part of Shotwell's duties included reinforcing the SpaceX culture as the company grows larger and larger and starts to resemble the traditional aerospace giants that it likes to mock. Shotwell can switch on an easygoing, affable air and address the entire company during a meeting, or convince a collection of possible recruits why they should sign up to be worked to the bone. During one such meeting with a group of interns, Shotwell pulled about 100 people into the corner of the cafeteria. She wore high-heel black boots, skin-tight jeans, a tan jacket, and a scarf, and had big hoop earrings dangling beside her shoulder-length blonde hair. Pacing back and forth in front of the group with a microphone in hand, she asked them to announce what school they came from and what project they were working on while at SpaceX. One student went to Cornell and worked on Dragon, another went to USC and did propulsion system design, and another went to the University of Illinois and worked with the aerodynamics group. It took about 30 minutes to make it all the way around the room, and the students were, at least by academic pedigree and bright-eyed enthusiasm, among the most impressive youngsters in the world. The students peppered Shotwell with questions, her best moment, her advice for being successful, SpaceX's competitive threats, and she replied with a mix of earnest answers and rah-rah stuff. Shotwell made sure to emphasize the lean, innovative edge SpaceX has over the more traditional aerospace companies. "Our competitors are scared shitless of us," Shotwell told the group. "The behemoths are going to have to figure out how to get it together and compete, and it is our job to have them die." One of SpaceX's biggest goals, Shotwell said, was to fly as often as possible. The company has never sought to make a fortune off each flight. It would rather make a little on each launch and keep the flights flowing. A Falcon 9 flight costs $60 million, and the company would like to see that figure drop to about $20 million through economies of scale and improvements in launch technology. SpaceX spent $2.5 billion to get 4 Dragon capsules to the ISS, 9 flights with the Falcon 9, and 5 flights with the Falcon 1. It's a price per launch total that the rest of the players in the industry cannot comprehend, let alone aspire to. I don't know what those guys do with their money, Shotwell said. They are smoking it. I just don't know. As Shotwell saw it, a number of new nations were showing interest in launches, eyeing communications technology as essential to growing their economies and leveling their status with developed nations. Cheaper flights would help SpaceX take the majority of the business from that new customer set. The company also expected to participate in an expanding market for human flights. SpaceX has never had any interest in doing the 5-minute tourist flights to low Earth orbit like Virgin Galactic and X-Corps. It does, however, have the ability to carry researchers to orbiting habitats being built by Bigelow Aerospace and to orbiting science labs being constructed by various countries. SpaceX will also start making its own satellites, turning the company into a one-stop space shop. All of these plans hinge on SpaceX being able to prove that it can fly on schedule every month and churn through the $5 billion backlog of launches. Most of our customers signed up early and wanted to be supportive and got good deals on their missions, she said. We are in a phase now where we need to launch on time and make launching Dragons more efficient. For a short while, the conversation with the interns bogged down. It turned to some of the annoyances of SpaceX's campus. The company leases its facility and has not been able to build things like a massive parking structure that would make life easier for its 3,000-person workforce. Shotwell promised that more parking, more bathrooms, and more of the freebies that technology startups in Silicon Valley offer their employees would be on the way. I want a daycare, she said. But it was while discussing SpaceX's grandest missions that Shotwell really came into her own and seemed to inspire the interns. Some of them clearly dreamed of becoming astronauts, and Shotwell said that working at SpaceX was almost certainly their best chance to get to space, now that NASA's astronaut corps had dwindled. Musk had made designing cool-looking, non-stay-puffed spacesuits a personal priority. They can't be clunky and nasty, Shotwell said. You have to do better than that. As for where the astronauts would go, well, there were the space habitats, the moon, and, of course, Mars as options. SpaceX has already started testing a giant rocket called the Falcon Heavy that will take it much farther into space than the Falcon 9, and it has another, even larger spaceship on the way. Our Falcon Heavy rocket will not take a busload of people to Mars, she said. So there's something after Heavy. We're working on it. To make something like that vehicle happen, she said, the SpaceX employees needed to be effective and pushy. Make sure your output is high, Shotwell said. If we're throwing a bunch of shit in your way, you need to be mouthy about it. That's not a quality that's widely accepted elsewhere, but it is at SpaceX. And if that sounded harsh, so be it. As Shotwell saw it, the commercial space race was coming down to SpaceX and China, and that's it. And in the bigger picture, the race was on to ensure man's survival. If you hate people and think human extinction is okay, then fuck it, Shotwell said. Don't go to space. If you think it is worth humans doing some risk management and finding a second place to go live, then you should be focused on this issue and willing to spend some money. I am pretty sure we will be selected by NASA to drop landers and rovers off on Mars. Then the first SpaceX mission will be to drop off a bunch of supplies, so that once people get there, there will be places to live and food to eat and stuff for them to do. It's talk like this that thrills and amazes people in the aerospace industry, who have long been hoping that some company would come along and truly revolutionize space travel. Aeronautics experts will point out that 20 years after the Wright brothers started their experiments, air travel had become routine. The launch business, by contrast, appears to have frozen. We've been to the moon, sent research vehicles to Mars, and explored the solar system. but all of these things are still immensely expensive, one-off projects. The cost remains extraordinarily high because of the rocket equation, said Carol Stoker, the planetary scientist at NASA. Thanks to military and government contracts from agencies like NASA, the aerospace industry has historically had massive budgets to work with and tried to make the biggest, most reliable machines it could. The business has been tuned to strive for maximum performance so that the aerospace contractors can say they met their requirements. That strategy makes sense if you're trying to send up a $1 billion military satellite for the U.S. government and simply cannot afford for the payload to blow up. But on the whole, this approach stifles the pursuit of other endeavors. It leads to bloat and excess and a crippling of the commercial space industry. Outside of SpaceX, the American launch providers are no longer competitive against their peers in other countries. They have limited launch abilities and questionable ambition. SpaceX's main competitor for domestic military satellites and other large payloads is United Launch Alliance, ULA, a joint venture formed in 2006 when Boeing and Lockheed Martin combined forces. The thinking at the time about the union was that the government did not have enough business for two companies and that combining the research and manufacturing work of Boeing and Lockheed would result in cheaper, safer launches. ULA has leaned on decades of work around the Delta, Boeing, and Atlas, Lockheed, launch vehicles, and has flown many dozens of rockets successfully, making it a model of reliability. But neither the joint venture, nor Boeing, nor Lockheed, both of which can afford commercial services on their own, come close to competing on price against SpaceX, the Russians, or the Chinese. For the most part, the global commercial market is dominated by Arianespace, Europe, Long March, China, or Russian vehicles, said Dave Bearden, the general manager of civil and commercial programs at the Aerospace Corporation. There are just different labor rates and differences in the way they are built. To put things more bluntly, ULA has turned into an embarrassment for the United States. In March 2014, ULA's then-CEO, Michael Gass, faced off against Musk during a congressional hearing that dealt in part with SpaceX's request to take on more of the government's annual launch load. A series of slides were rolled out that showed how the government payments for launches have skyrocketed since Boeing and Lockheed went from a duopoly to a monopoly. According to Musk's math presented at the hearing, ULA charged $380 million per flight, while SpaceX would charge $90 million per flight. The $90 million figure was higher than SpaceX's standard $60 million because the government has certain additional requirements for particularly sensitive launches. By simply picking SpaceX as its launch provider, Musk pointed out, the government would save enough money to pay for the satellite going on the rocket. Gass had no real retort. He claimed Musk's figures for the ULA launch price were inaccurate, but failed to provide a figure of his own. The hearing also came as tensions between the United States and Russia were running high due to Russia's aggressive actions in Ukraine. Musk rightly noted that the United States could soon be placing sanctions on Russia that could carry over to aerospace equipment. ULA, as it happens, relies on Russian-made engines to send up sensitive U.S. military equipment in its Atlas V rockets. Our Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy launch vehicles are truly American, Musk said. We design and manufacture our rockets in California and Texas. Gass countered that ULA had bought a 2-year supply of Russian engines and purchased the blueprints to the machines and had them translated from Russian to English. And he said this with a straight face. A few months after the hearing, ULA replaced Gass as CEO and signed a deal with Blue Origin to develop American-made rockets. Some of the most disheartening moments of the hearing arrived when Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama took the microphone for questioning. ULA has manufacturing facilities in Alabama and close ties to the senator. Shelby felt compelled to play the role of hometown booster by repeatedly pointing out that ULA had enjoyed 68 successful launches, and then asking Musk what he made of that accomplishment. The aerospace industry stands as one of Shelby's biggest